SBS Radio.
Well, there's a similar story from my country because I'm Warramai from the mid-north coast. And the trees that were there when the white people came were absolutely huge. They were as much as 60 feet across the base or more.
Yeah.
There are photographs to prove it. And these often were cedar or rosewood. And they were torn down in order to be shipped off to line the drawing rooms and build the boats in Europe. And there's a story of an Aboriginal woman crying, and the timber getter said, "Why do you stand there and cry?" And she said, "Because this tree is my brother." So, yes, it illustrates the powerlessness of Aboriginal people to stop the decimation of their lands. And, of course, you know, the felling of these trees changed the environment irrevocably. Some of these trees have been growing for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And you can't get them back that quickly, you know.
Yeah. Now, going back to the Dreamtime, it's something we talk about in Australia. People just talk about the Dreamtime without understanding exactly where it comes from, where it goes, and its significance. And as you said, it's usually misinterpreted.
The interesting thing is that word came from an anthropologist who has an extraordinarily good reputation. By the name of Stanner. He was working with Aboriginal people in Alice Springs in the early part of the 20th century, and he was talking to a group of Aboriginal lawmen about their law. They use a word which I can never pronounce very well, but it's like Chakurpra. Chakurpra. And that encapsulates all of the prescriptions for what it means to be a human being, like how to behave. It encapsulates the stories of the ancestral heroes, the relationship to the constellations, where these stories are often held, all kinds of things. It's to do with law in Chakurpra. And he said to them, "What is the word in English that you think would most closest to that word?" And they thought about it for some time. I think they came back with a very clever answer, because there is actually no word in English. But they said to him, "Well, the word dreaming, because it is when you are in the state between sleep and wakefulness that you are most in touch with the eternal. This is like the meditative state, or if things come to you in dreams, or that kind of thing, is when you're most in touch with the eternal." So that is what why they use the word. So you perhaps you can understand from that how misused the word has become.
Yeah.
Because there is no Aboriginal philosophy called the dreaming. There's Aboriginal philosophy in the Kimberley called Lalai. There is Aboriginal philosophy with the Aranda people called Chakurpra, and there are many other words for all the different languages across the country, but there is no philosophy in dreaming.
Yeah.
It is really like an inadequate English word
that
was used to help people, try to help people understand
more or less,
about Aboriginal spirituality.
Yeah. Which was one of your specialties is dealing with social inequalities. So, will you be running workshops on this, or will you touch on these social inequalities during the festival?
Oh well, I'm just going to be connected through the internet to this panel. I'm going to be there on the screen because, as you know, I'm in New York at the moment.
Yeah,
there are fabulous workshops happening at this conference, I have to say. It's really quite a feast. If people get the opportunity, they really should go there, because there are a lot of very knowledgeable Aboriginal writers and activists and academics involved in this conference. My work on social inequalities, I've done quite a lot of work on race and gender and those kinds of things in the history work that I do.
Yeah.
And it does come into focus with Aboriginal philosophy too, in that Aboriginal philosophy really, if you like, describes for us a world before colonization and before commodification of people. And so there was not the social inequality in the society circumscribed by Aboriginal philosophy.
Yeah.
Not at all. And some of us have been fortunate enough to be a part of that kind of society in Aboriginal Australia, which really values the individual for what they are,
yeah,
and not for what they should be or could be. It's a very beautiful way of being, and it is a philosophy that has produced very gentle and beautiful people. I've had the opportunity to know older Aboriginal men in years gone by who were raised within this philosophy and who were just good people to be around. And there are, you know, people like that still in Aboriginal Australia that I've had the fortune to be able to spend time with.
Yeah. Would you say the pre-colonial Aboriginal, typical pre-colonial, because there were so many different nations and cultures, would you say that the majority would have been very egalitarian societies?
Most definitely, yeah. More than that, they were inclusive, but also highly formal and very regimented and not very forgiving for people who transgressed. There wasn't a hierarchy such as you find with tribal societies. I know people in Aboriginal Australia talk about tribes. It's really like a handy word about the social organisation was not that of tribes. It was really that of clans, family groups. Small family groups moved together in circumscribed patterns over country that they had responsibility for. And they had very formal relationships with their neighbours. People did not go on country that they did not belong to without invitation.
Yeah.
Formal invitations, in fact. So if you can imagine the society before mass-produced communications and entertainment, people were living in drama. Their lives were quite formal. They had song and dance and theatre and stories that enriched their lives. A lot of what they did was very intellectually demanding.
Want to hear more stories like this? Subscribe to our regular podcasts on iTunes.